title, Genjo Koan, is, it in itself is an interesting kind of topic. And I just wanted to then, by talking about that, reiterate what we've been talking about. Hermester Diu translates it as the problem of everyday life. I actually like the way that Hermester Hubert has translated it, which is the spiritual problem as it manifests before our very eyes in daily life. Or the spiritual question, that's what it is, the question that manifests itself. And the reason I like that is because there are two qualities of the word koan, two kind of meanings or aspects of the word koan. The word koan kind of literally means a public case, and so from the Chinese, kuman, public case. And what that implies is that it's a kind of public problem that is raised and solved in a kind of public situation, a problem that's raised and solved in a public situation, a sort of dialogue. And over time, the idea of a koan has, what that implies is a problem that a person brings to a spiritual teacher to ask for clarification about. And that question or that problem that a person brings to a spiritual teacher to ask a question about is the question of daily life and how it can be handled. It is often two contradictory issues that seem to be in conflict and we have difficulty resolving. And so that's why we study it, that's why we look at it and talk about it. In what we've talked about so far, there is the problem of discrimination and unity and how to bring those things together and live beyond them. So in other words, there's all this kind of multiplicity, all this stuff going on, all these challenges that we have, and then there's this issue of unity. How do we blend that we might experience? How do we make those two things match? How do we make the seeming? A koan is not just in regard to a spiritual problem. It's not just a question that is answered once. It's not just a question that you kind of resolve and know the solution to, like 2 + 2 = 4. It is, in a sense, something that that arises and will always be with us. It will always be an aspect of our life. It will always be something that we need to look at and handle in a new way. And once we begin to understand our particular koan, because each one of us, in a sense, is in existence because of a spiritual question. And it's a unique question to us, which even though we learn how to handle it through practice, we may not ever actually be able to articulate as, like a simple problem, 2 + 2 = 4. Okay? But nevertheless, we do, even though we can't necessarily articulate it, we do come to understand what it is and be able to live and work with it. Always, it will arise in our minds. Always, it will be part of how we kind of deal with the world, no matter how enlightened we become. We will just be better or worse at handling it. Okay, so that's why I like it as the spiritual question as it manifests before our very eyes in daily life, because it gives less expression to the idea of a problem that needs to be solved once and then goes away. Okay? It's a spiritual question that will be kind of always with us and that we actually, in a sense, get used to. We get familiar with. We understand how to live with it and deal with it. And so what this chapter is talking about is, in one sense, the simple problem of the difficulties of daily life, In another sense, it's this other profound issue that we're talking about. How do we handle our particular spiritual question, problem, as it manifests in our daily life all the time throughout? And this, so this is the basic question behind this chapter that Dogen's talking about. He's exploring some of the ideas with. He's not really providing us with necessarily an answer to our particular problem. He's more talking about the generalities of the koan and how we come to address it through training and how we can begin to talk about it in terms of, and so in a sense this chapter can be talked about what living from Zen practice looks like. And it's somewhat surprising in the sense that it's not like it looks like you get up in the morning and, you know, meditate for a half an hour and you say the five thoughts when you eat your meals, or you say the reverse when you are kind of brushing your teeth, or you walk this way and you stand that way. Well, that's somewhat part of it. What he's talking about is how we're living with our own minds. So we continue on, and I'll skip a little bit here. When a man first sees the truth, he automatically transcends the boundaries of truth. Since the truth has been awakened within him, he simultaneously his own original faith. It is normal for a man, that sentence seems to be talked about, actually. So again, here we are, we're looking at ourselves in terms of meditation, we're learning how to sit, we're learning how to precepts, and this opens up part of ourselves, a new part of ourselves, this kind of deeper part of ourselves, and that could be described as kind of seeing the truth. And this changes things because it addresses our fundamental perspective of having a self and what that self signifies. It sort of it helps us to see through the self. And that changes our bodies, and it in fact, what it means to say it transcends the boundaries of truth is that it means no longer are we constrained by our conceptual understanding of life and death. No longer are we constrained by our discriminative. There is another way of understanding than from our discriminative view. And each one of us, again, needs to, and this is part of our koan, needs to understand how we get trapped by our discrimination. It either must be this or it must be that. And if it's this, then I suffer. If it's that, then I suffer. So what's the deal? Okay, that's what our minds are basically. And once we transcend this, then we're living from this deeper place, a place which goes beyond duality, beyond unity, and from which we can actually begin to use more effectively our discriminatory factors in terms of discriminating wisdom. It is normal for a man whilst sailing, so we'll move on to another idea. It is normal for a man whilst sailing, although similar idea or related, whilst sailing and observing the shore to think the shore is moving instead of the boat. But should he look carefully, he will find that it is the boat which is doing the actual moving. In the same way as this, it is because a man observes everything from the mistaken point of view of his body and mind that he comes to the conclusion that they are eternal. However, should he learn to observe them correctly, as a result of penetrating truth, he will discover that no form whatsoever attaches. And this, again, is that problem of duality and you. From the point of view of our discriminatory mind, we see things in terms of our bodies and minds. We see things in terms of I and what I need, and everything is related to that. The more deeply we penetrate into practice, the more we begin to see that that I actually doesn't exist way that we thought it did before. It's a construct. It's a thing that we're constantly generating. And if you think about it, you'll kind of get a glimpse of this. You know, you just think about how your ideas and self are different than they were a year ago. And your views, even your political views, even that they were a week ago, they're just different somehow. Even though you didn't necessarily set out to change them, but they're different. And our self is constantly like that. It's just this constantly moving forward, evolving kind of thing. the more deeply we let go of our perception of body and mind, the more we begin to see through that whole tunnel. And then we begin to see things from this enlightened not-self. Now, there's a discussion then about wood and fire and all of that. I'll just read it. The wood that is burned upon a fire becomes ashes. It does not again become wood. You must not think that wood comes first and afterwards. You must clearly understand that a piece of burning wood has both a before and an after. However, in spite of the fact that it has before and after, it is cut off therefrom. Ashes, however, have before and after. In the same way that wood does, in the same way that wood does not again become wood after becoming ashes, so in the very same way, man is not reborn again as man after death. It is therefore correct for Buddhism to say that life does not become death, and equally true to say that death. The Buddha himself constantly preached this. The two above views are called non-life and non-death. The two, life and death, are simply positions in time, as are spring. Winter no more becomes spring than spring becomes summer. The moon reflected in water is the same as the inlet. Okay, so this issue of time then becomes, okay, there's another question here. What do we do with this issue of time? There is a quality of practice which one of the monks or Master Kuten describes as stepping off into emptiness. In terms of our kind of daily life, there's a kind of piece of advice that you might encounter in Zen, which is to let go of everything, let go of whatever arises in your body. And in terms of our monastic practice, the ambition, the intention, the our goal is to give up everything, to let go of everything. And so when you see a monk, what that monk represents is the willingness, the effort, the training to give up everything. We give up our hair, our hairstyle, the way that we look, the clothes that we wear, our schedule, our ability to earn a living, our ability to have a spouse, to pair bond and all of that. We give up everything with, in the beginning, or maybe it's already acknowledged in the beginning, with the faith that everything can go in a formal sense. Everything will go. Everything passes. We are giving up everything in a formal sense, in an external and formal sense. When we die, we all realize, you know, there's that kind of common saying, you can't take it with you. Well, it is in fact the case that you can't take any of this formal thing. And what we're trying to do from this perspective and this is cultivate this letting go of everything, the habit of mind, which just is willing to. This could also be called an idea of renunciation. This idea of letting go of everything permeates all of practice. So lay people have it too. You have the idea of renunciation. You just practice it in a slightly different way. And it could be described simply as the practice of applying meditation throughout the day in whatever condition or circumstance. It doesn't mean that all your relationships go away in this formal sense. It doesn't mean that you wear funny clothes, or you have to shake your head, or do anything like that. It just means you apply meditation as deeply as you can throughout life, and that changes us. Now, the reality, say, of my life as a monk is that I still have, for instance, family relations. You know, people who I see and talk to, I'm going to go visit them in a couple of days. I still love them. As far as I do, and I deal pretty well with my family. But anyway, there are still problems that arise. There's still a relationship. We have, things we talk about, all that kind of thing. And on a formal level, I have set myself this project of being a monk, and so I live apart from them. I don't necessarily spend a whole bunch of time with them, and my relationship has changed. The critical thing in terms of just being a regular human being is that I do always try to bring meditation. And this is the quality of giving up everything, of stepping off into emptiness. So part of the thing about that is, you know, like for a month, living on alms. One of the kind of hallmarks of monastic life is to live on alms. You basically say, I'm going to live and have faith in the merit of practice, and that in the faith that other people will be able to see the merit of practice and support what I'm doing. Otherwise, you know, if I were to take the rules quite literally, I could starve to death. Particularly if I wasn't taking the rules quite literally, and people thought, Reverend Leon, I don't know about him, I'm going to not give him what, you know, support. And so, again, it's this idea of stepping off into the unknown and being willing to just live in that place and see what is good to do. Now, how this relates to time is that, and this idea of every moment being cut off from the previous moment, is that regardless of what is going on, if we are able to sit still in the moment and simply see what is good to do, there actually is no reason for the past to determine what the future will be. The past is, in a sense, in a very real sense, cut off from the present. We can do something different than the momentum of whatever conditions of life are implying we should do. There's a kind of flow of life, there's a flow of conditions which we are in the middle of. But we, because of this quality, because of the nature of reality, because of this possibility of stepping off into emptiness, because of the truth in capital letters of the scripture, we actually have the ability to do something different. It may just be a slight difference, but it is not. And this is what he's getting at with this idea of, this is as I see it, what he's getting at with this idea of the wood and the fire and the ashes, that there isn't a thing, there isn't a self which determines what the next, there isn't a continuous self which we're stuck with. There is a momentum of cause and effect, and sometimes that can be very difficult to deal with and change. But in the moment, in each moment, there is this possibility of doing so. And at the moment of death, it will all become apparent that it is quite different because we'll be dead. But at the same time, there is the teaching of, and at the same time, there is the teaching of karma and this momentum of habiting. So that's where the realm of our training is. We can know that it is through meditation that we begin to cut that, our bonds to that flow of getting moving on. The moon reflected in water is the same as the enlightenment that a man can reach. The moon is not wetted by the water, and water does not become. However much light the moon may radiate, its reflection can still be seen in the puddle. In the same way, the full moon in the limitless sky may be seen reflected, suspended from a grass blade. Man is not restrained by enlightenment, and the moon is not restrained by. Man puts nothing in the way of enlightenment, and the dewdrop puts nothing in the way of either the moon or the limitless sky. In addition to this, the deeper the moon's reflection, the higher the moon. The length of time of the reflection is in ratio to the depth of the water and the fullness. I don't think I'll try to point that.
That just went.
Yeah, in a sense, it does that for me. So I'll just leave it there, and if you want, come back and over time just reflect. When a man has an incomplete knowledge of the truth, he feels that he already knows enough, and when he has understood the truth fully, he feels sure that something is lacking. So this is a very good kind of little piece of information to keep in there. That, first of all, you know, in a sense, we all kind of want the enlightenment, which kind of gives us the confidence that what we're doing is right. Okay? And that may not be the nature of enlightenment. That it's not, enlightenment isn't about kind of being the best at being right, or being, having both the best ability to see right and wrong clearly, in a deeper sense. Okay, so, and in a sense, enlightenment is not the confirmation that will make our inadequacies go away. Okay? It does help us deeply with our inadequacies, but they don't stop arising in our minds. We begin to see them and begin to work with them as the spiritual problem manifests. We begin to see through them more clearly, but they're still there. And it is just useful to know that when we think, oh, I've really got it, that's a time when you think, well, maybe not. At least not. If you can see no land or mountains when sailing, the ocean appears rounded, but it is neither round nor square, being in possession of myriad characters. Some people regard it as a palace and others as a form of ornamentation, but it is only for a very short time that it appears round. This distance is constantly changing. We must view all things bearing this in mind. There are many things within the world of enlightenment, but the Zen trainee can only see as far as his present understanding. If one would know the truth, it is essential to know that the ocean and the mountains have many other attributes, in addition to being square or circular, and that there are many other worlds in addition to this. Our immediate surroundings are of no account. It is essential to know that the ocean is contained in a single drop of dew, and that the truth is manifesting itself eternally. That is an important thing. But let's go back here and talk about this ocean business. We were talking recently about the importance of, or the value of, well, peripherally, about the value of training with others. And one of the things that happens is, you know, if you just kind of stay in your room and meditate all the time and, you know, kind of go to the kitchen and get the food that you like and are independently wealthy and can do whatever, is that you're in effect in the middle of the ocean where everything looks around. Once you have to kind of get out and deal with other people, then things look different. So you can actually feel fairly peaceful and great when you don't have to deal with anybody and all that stuff. But then you have to deal with your boss or your coworkers or whatever. And, oh, well, maybe I'm not quite as enlightened as I thought. Or maybe the world's more complicated than I thought. And training gives us the ability to see that and to understand it. That's one of the kind of ideas present in this. It also, what he's talking about here is, again, this idea of the world is really big. The Buddha is really big. I mean, yeah, I sometimes think of myself as being a tiny piece of plank and floating around the ocean in terms of myself and the Dharma. There's just all kinds of stuff in it. The Buddha taught, you know, what I know is as a handful of leaves. Oh, he said, he's walking the forest with some monks, and he said, see all these leaves? And then he picked up a handful of leaves, and he said, what I know is as this forest of leaves, as to this handful of leaves, and the handful of leaves is what I teach. Okay, so even the Buddha Dharma is just after a fairly narrow kind of part of life, fairly small part of life. And yet it's a critical part, because it goes right to the core of our being in terms of why we're here, what we're doing, how we come to exist. Once we understand that those central questions, then we can deal with all the rest of it. It is essential to know that the ocean is contained within a single drop of water and that the truth is manifesting itself eternally on the very spot on which we are now standing. You can kind of tattoo that on the inside of your eyelid. Right? It doesn't say anything about who it is that he's talking to. It doesn't say, Well, for those of us who are monks, or those of us who have taken the precepts, or those of us who have not taken the precepts, or those of us who practice the Dharma, or those of us who X, Y, or Z, it is saying the truth is manifesting itself eternally on the very spot on which we are now. This is for all beings, all living things. It's right here. It's right here. We don't have to look. The ocean is limitless no matter how far fish may swim therein. The sky is limitless no matter how far a bird may fly in. From the very beginning of all things, both the fish and the birds have been one with the ocean and the sky respectively. Understand clearly that when a great need appears, a great use also. When there is a small need, there is a small use. It is obvious then that full use is made of all things at all times, according to the necessity there. When birds are out of unity with the sky, or fish out of unity with the ocean, for the life of fish is lived in the ocean, and the life of birds is lived in the sky. It is equally true that the life of the sky is lived in the birds, and the life of the ocean is lived in. Birds are life and fish are life. It is easily possible to find many examples of the above. The truth is manifesting right in the very spot in which we are standing, and we are not separate from the conditions of our life. The conditions of our life are part of who we are and what we do and how our training manifests. We can never step outside of those conditions. It is kind of useless to think, if I was with one friend of mine, said she used to think of monk. She used to kind of be driving through the Berkeley Hills and see houses and think, oh, if I had that house. And lived there, then because she would be imagining a particular life in that house, with family and job and all that. If I had that house, I could live there. That context. It is useless to think that any other context than the one that we are immediately in right now is what we need to look somewhere else for what we're doing to actually find a peace. Of course, that doesn't stand against the necessity for change and doing things differently and all. But all of that changes within the acceptance of our context. Sometimes accepting our context may mean, oh, I need to make a change. But that's only because the reality of the context reflects our mind. And so by accepting the context, we may be able to say, oh, I need to make it. Understand clearly that when I'll read this again. Understand clearly that when a great need appears, a great use appears also. When there's a small need, there is a small use. The very life that we're leading right now, whether it is significant, in worldly terms or insignificant, is vital. Is vital life right now. It's vital in terms of the truth. It's vital in terms of our own training, in terms of our own life. It's such a great relief to realize you don't have to discriminate about yourself in terms of, what you're doing in your life. Like living here in Columbia, South Carolina, this very kind of sleepy temple, for me is a bit like a retreat in a sense. I'm not really doing a lot. I feel like it's very valuable to me and great, and I'm quite happy to be doing it. But I'm not like that. I'm not working for the order, I'm not the abbot of a temple, I'm not in charge of a temple, I'm not really doing anything, of profound significance. I'm not like teaching hundreds of people or anything like that. And still, there is a use, and I'm quite happy and content to be fulfilling that use. There is a need in me, and respond, and my presence, I hope, responds to a need here, and so I'm quite happy to fulfill that. I don't think I'm going to be, it doesn't look like it's in the card for me to be famous or anything like that. It's just not going to happen. But, I think, oh, okay, well, even though part of me kind of wants that, part of me kind of wants that, kind of think, well, maybe it's just as well. We can learn to be content with the small use that our present life is. And we can also be content and not blown away, blown by the tides of fame and gain, if we happen to be fulfilling it. It is easily possible to find examples of the above idea. In spite of the facts, although when I thought about it, I didn't really come up with ideas, so, but maybe you can, maybe it will be easy for you. In spite of the facts of training and enlightenment, and the variation in the man, in the length of a man's lifespan, all ways of living are the very personification of truth. Should a fish try to go beyond the limitations of the ocean, however, or a bird go beyond the limitations of the sky, there will be no resting place for either. When we are discontent, when we are not content with our present context, when we're trying to leap outside of it, then should you touch the truth, your every action will be vital and expressed the way naturally, for your every action will be fully understood truth, performed in ordinary daily activities. Rules for meditation there. This truth can never be understood as a result of conceptual duality, such as big and small, or subject and object. The way of truth existed from the very beginning and makes no special now, which is just as it should be. It is because the way of truth is as stated above, that after taking up one thing, you understand that one, and after finishing a practice, you understand that practice. This is the way in which Buddhism itself. It is not possible for us to know clearly when we are giving deep expression to the way of truth, since it is an action which arises simultaneously. It is wrong to believe that one is fully aware of enlightenment as personal knowledge, even after enlightenment. That which is intuitive cannot necessarily be given impression in definite form, even though enlightenment is. So this comes back to that thing I was saying about the koan, and we may never be able to articulate what our particular is. In the same way, we may not be able to kind of put our finger on what enlightenment is. And in a sense, the way that I have experienced the evolution, the changes that have been brought about by my practice, have not been kind of this, sort of revelatory certainty that that I could call my own, this kind of personal possession, which I can say, yes, this happened, and by God, I know what's right. It is more just at some kind of more fundamental level, there's been a change, a brightening, and a contest certainty, not about the rights of my actions, but about the value of training. So as I continue to apply training, that kind of transformation continues, and it's my ability to deal with my life using training deepens, and I can see. And we can also use this as a, I often thought to myself, I can use this as a guide for myself, as a form or a template for my life. In other words, sometimes in life, it's just kind of confusing, and I'm not really sure, what I'm doing or why I'm doing it or anything like that. And I may not have any clarity about it or even want to be doing what I'm doing. But I can entrust, and at those times I can entrust myself to practice and trust that going through that period of darkness or confusion or unclarity, by guiding myself with practice, then I'm more likely to come out on the other side with some kind of clarity or understanding. Because, as Dogen says, by just simply doing the practice, we are giving expression to enlightenment. We are giving expression to this deeper. And so setting up our, kind of going through whatever it is that we have a state of life during periods of clarity and unclarity, during periods of aridity and great flowering, just steadily going forth one step at a time, that is really the end. That is really the lesson of enlightenment, to just steadily go forth. And then, one summer day, a Zen teacher sat fanning himself when a monk asked, "Since the nature of wind is stationary and universally present, why do you use a fan?" The teacher replied, "Although you know its nature to be stationary, you do not know why it is universally present. Why is it universally present?" For answer, the teacher merely continued fanning himself. The true way of transmission and enlightenment, which is the result of real experience, is the same as this. One who thinks that fanning is not needed simply because wind is stationary by nature and requires no fan, since it can be sensed, understands nothing whatsoever of its nature. It is because it is eternally here that the wind Buddhism makes the earth golden to rivers. The truth is right where we are standing. It manifests right underneath our feet. We need to give expression to it. The Dharma is right here where we are. We need to give expression to it by this. That's you. That's why we're, and we're, you know, sorry, but we're just kind of constantly hammer at that point. Put it into practice, put it into practice. This is how we fan the fires of our heart, and about that.
Too many.
Where do you start?
Well, it's a great thing, you know. And again, there are just some parts of Dogen which you read and you hear about, and they just make no sense. They just don't. Even though you might be able to understand conceptually what they're talking about, you just don't make any sense. And that seems to be fine on a natural sort of state of human existence. We can just continue forward with teaching into practice and come back to it every now and then. Reread it for yourself and see, oh, maybe this will speak. And for me, that has always been the case. Oh, there's something more here. As I train and begin to see, oh, this is where this can be quite helpful. Oh, there's that idea from Dogen that applies in this situation and explains this current circumstance. How can I make sure I see that and practice in accordance with it? And over time,